Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders. Hey everyone, Watto here, and you are about to hear a fantastic episode of the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, talking about alcohol use disorder, hosted by Drs. Carolyn Chan and Sean Cohen. Paul and I love addiction medicine so much that we wanted to bring that mini-series back into the main feed. You can still find all their episodes at Curbsiders Addiction Medicine feed, but we're going to be posting all their new episodes going forward on our feed. So without further ado, enjoy this fantastic conversation on alcohol use disorder. Paul, I saw an ad for burial plots, and I thought to myself, you know what I thought, Paul?
No.
This is the last thing I need.
It's not bad.
What's yours?
It's also death-related. Why are ophthalmologists the longest-living specialty?
I don't know.
Because they always die late.
That's all right. That's all right.
I always expect more from you. I don't know. You just pearls before swine. But yeah.
All right, Paul. Well, they can't all be the greatest.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like Moral Hospital and its affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, probably the primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hey, Paul, how are you doing?
I'm a primary care physician, Matt. I'm okay. How are you doing?
No, I want to, whoever that listener was that didn't like it, we're just going to keep sticking to them.
Just going to find me murdered.
They apparently think you have the world's biggest ego and that you think you are the primary care physician. I think in America's heart, in the heart of our listeners, I think you are the primary care, America's primary care clinician, Paul. So
sure.
I stand by it. Paul, how about you tell people what is that we do on Curbsiders and introduce our two wonderful co-hosts for tonight?
Yeah, Matt, other than making me deeply uncomfortable, we are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We typically use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. However, this time the experts are us, not us, Matt, but we have other smart people with us to help us out. We're going to go through a couple, and by a couple, I mean at least four journal articles that have come up of late that are of interest to us, and we'll talk about their relevance, their quality, and sort of how to kind of critically think through them. At least that's what we're going to teach. And to do that, we are joined by our resident epidemiologist, Dr. Rahul Ganatra, and we are also joined by associate writer of Curbsiders Digest, Dr. Laura Glick. Guys, how are you?
Great.
Good. Happy to be here.
Laura, returning for the second time, so this will be like a regular, hopefully a regular thing for you, joining. We're happy to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
And Rahul, always excited for critical appraisal. So I think we should just jump right in. And Rahul, I'm gonna need your help here because we're gonna be talking about some vitamin D. This was actually a sub-study of the VITAL trial. So, and this was by Chu et al. It appeared in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Was just published the end of 2024, early 2025. And this is a follow-on study to the VITAL trial, which had over 28,000 patients looking at. It was vitamin D and omega-3 trying to prevent cancer and heart disease. And that larger trial was a negative trial on those terms, but they wanted to look back at a subset of patients to see if vitamin D and omega-3 could prevent falls. There's this background that vitamin D receptors in muscle, and omega-3 seems to help maybe with it's anti-inflammatory. Maybe it helps with protein synthesis and reduce protein degradation. So maybe these things could help with muscle strength, muscle function. Is anybody else confused about whether or not this actually works? Because as much as you hear about vitamin D, you would think that it just does everything well. Paul, I'll start with you.
Yeah, no, I thought that it was the secret to immortality. So I have to assume that this is the study that's going to actually confirm that. And if anything, it's going to make these people stronger and we'll all be superhumans by the time we're 74.
Yeah. Laura, is it your opinion that vitamin D has like a really good public image?
That's a good question. I think that there are a lot of studies on vitamin D. People really push it in a lot of different ways. Although I will say that there have been a fair amount of negative or fair number of negative studies as of late.
Yeah. I feel like that is true. And so me as a clinician, I'm confused because I mostly am seeing these negative trials come across, but there's just still wild enthusiasm for vitamin D in general. And it's one of the easiest things to get anybody to take, I feel like. They're just like, they want you to check their vitamin D. They want to know if they should take it, and they're happy to take it if you tell them that. Rahul, as a hospitalist, you're probably not dealing with that as much, but I mean, in your opinion, like when you're interfacing with people, do they seem to like love vitamin D?
Well, I mean, you're right that as a hospitalist, this is not really at the top of my problem lists, but you know, it does come up a lot in transitional issues. And I have observed that for treatments like this that feel kind of, you know, multiple mechanisms, multiple effects, like really a confusing cause and effect relationship between, you know, really any outcome you can choose. I sort of feel like this is kind of ripe for every few years, another observational study coming out. I didn't know anything about the mechanism here. And so when I'm reading a study like this, one of the things that I, as a non-subject matter expert, seek to understand first is, okay, what's the proposed mechanism here? And this wasn't really anything that I was familiar with. I don't know, Matt, you're interested in metabolism and stuff. Is this something you sort of knew about, or was this new to you as well?
I knew a little bit about it because just over the years when I was wondering why are people like speculating that vitamin D might have anything to do with falls, you know, because when you first learn about vitamin D, it's usually in the context of bone metabolism. So yeah, I had looked this up before. And you mentioned observational studies. I mean, that's, I think a lot of the enthusiasm has come from observational or longitudinal studies, not necessarily randomized controlled trials. So this VITAL trial was a large, well-done randomized controlled trial. And this was a sub-study of the VITAL trial. So to get to the top line results, this was a negative trial, this sub-study that we're going to be talking about. And they took 1,054 patients that were generally healthy older adults. They had to be in the Boston area. They had to be capable of making it into Boston to the center where they were going to do this like muscle performance testing. And neither vitamin D or omega-3 improved the things they tested here, which was like grip strength, walking speed, balance, chair stands, or the timed get up and go test, or they call it the TUG test in the literature, which is fun, Paul. And they monitored this over 2 years. And there was just no benefit observed. In fact, they found that in one of the subgroups, and I think we can, this would just be hypothesis generating, Rahul. I don't think we could draw like any strong conclusions from this. But in the subgroup analysis, that people who already had like normal baseline or higher baseline vitamin D levels might have actually done worse on the timed get up and go test when they followed them out.
Yeah. I mean, to interpret a finding like this, I sort of come back to the biologic plausibility. Like, is there, you know, some negative mm-hmm. feedback that could induce with vitamin D supplementation that might matter? I think the fact that this was just one out of several outcomes that they included increases my suspicion that could have just been a chance finding. Yeah. And all of the performance measures declined in both groups over time, suggesting that those things don't remain static anyway.
Yeah. So the patients were getting either 2,000 units of vitamin D a day or 1 gram of omega-3 fatty acids. And it was a mixture of EPA and DHA, which in the literature they call the marine version of omega-3. So just asking you all that, you know, I know you had a chance to look through the paper. Laura, maybe we'll start with you. Anything that jumped out to you here as, you know, something that you thought was off about the study or could have introduced chance or bias to the results?
Yeah, it's a good question. Always something that we're looking for with these studies. I think it's important to recognize that this was a sub-study that included about 1,000 people out of the over 25,000 participants in the larger VITAL trial. And this subgroup turned out to be a younger, healthier subpopulation of the parent child. So there is some introduction of selection bias, which I think is important to be aware of. I think it's a little bit slightly less relevant given that it's a negative study, but still important to consider.
Yeah. Rahul, how about you? Anything that jumps out?
Yeah. I mean, thinking about how could these results be wrong, this being a negative study, Laura talked about how, you know, selection bias would be introduced by this being a subset. And it kind of undoes some of the benefits of randomization, having just a subset of people participate if they participate for reasons, like in this case, them being younger and healthier and able to come to study visits makes them different from the randomized population. So selection bias, definitely important to think about. For any negative study, I'm always thinking, okay, was this set up to find a difference if one existed? And the way that we would typically evaluate that would be by looking at their sample size justification, or commonly sample size calculations, some measure of the or estimate of the effect size that they're looking for. In this study, I think this was most likely a convenience sample of patients who were able to come for those additional visits. So I'm reading between the lines that was probably how they arrived at the final size. So we don't really know whether, you know, what sort of effect of vitamin D on these metrics the study was powered for. But the fact that all of those mobility and performance parameters really did not show any large gains in either group, to me, suggests that there's probably not a large effect. If there was one, you know, this study, I think, probably would have found it, even though we don't have those sample size calculations.
Yeah. Paul, any comments before we get to the, you know, the bottom line, the take home points on this?
No, it's Rahul said it far more eloquently than I could have. The fact that this is consistent with so many studies that have not found benefit also just, maybe this is sort of my own, addresses sort of my own bias towards how I feel about vitamin D anymore at this point. But I think the fact that it was a negative trial makes me less worried for any potential bias that is actually introduced into it. But so it was not terribly surprising to me.
Yeah, I think this was well done. I guess my take home on vitamin D after just kind of the reason I wanted to cover this was just to sort of review the latest in the literature on vitamin D and try to get like a sense of, because there's so many of these trials that seem to come through and they get swirled up in my mind. So many of them are positive or negative, but I think in general now on balance, it really looks like it's hard to prove that vitamin D prevents falls. And in some of the trials where they're using higher doses of vitamin D, there's actually some signal for increased falls, which is concerning because most of the formulations of vitamin D that I'm seeing out there are high doses. You know, people are taking 50,000 a week, 5,000 a day, things like that. And I'm not clear on who actually benefits and exactly what dose people should be taking. Most of the guidelines recommend checking vitamin D in people that are at risk for vitamin D deficiency, like people who are institutionalized, because I guess they're not getting much sun exposure. People with osteoporosis, just to make sure that they're, you know, because you're trying to work on their bone metabolism there. But for just your average person, you should not be checking and aggressively repleting vitamin D, even though people ask me to do that all the time. And it's such an easy thing to like make the number look better. I'm less convinced now that we're actually helping these people by making their vitamin D levels better.
No, I genuinely think that's the appeal for vitamin D specifically, because it's so easy to make number go up, which is also deeply satisfying. Like, it's one of those things where like, well, at least in the outpatient setting, so I'm sad sometimes and my left pinky hurts, like, check a vitamin D, and it comes back like 24, you're like, take some vitamin D, and then it's better than 30 and they're still sad, but it like, at least you moved something. So I just think it's tempting to try to look for something where you're actually doing benefit, because you can actually make the little marker move into the right range.
I have heard some people suggest like we should, if we are going to do future studies of vitamin D, why don't we say like, we're going to try to get everyone to 40 and see if that like, and then the dose can be variable based on like with blood pressure trials, we're not like, we're going to put everybody on the maximum dose and just see what happens. It's like, we're going to try to get everyone to some target biometric assessment where their blood pressure. So maybe they have to do something like that with vitamin D, but I suspect if we would have found like a clear signal, if it was clearly going to be beneficial. So I would say I give this a 3 hotcakes rating, actually, because this was a sub study of a larger study. I think the larger study was probably a 4.5 or a 5, but this one, because it's like a sub study, giving it a 3. I think it's less important than the parent trial that it came from. Well, if there's no other comments, then Paul, I think we should talk about one of your favorite medications, one that I know you like to prescribe in high doses for everyone, and that would be gabapentin.
Thank you, Matt. Yeah, it's funny because I've actually been using gabapentin for off-label uses more and more frequently now, and we could talk about that. But the paper I would like to talk about is Assessing the Risk for Falls in Older Adults After Initiating Gabapentin versus Duloxetine, which is recently published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which I would just like to say as an aside, have been crushing it lately. The Annals, I feel like, have been publishing really interesting stuff. Maybe I'll just leave it at that. I don't want to get Matt angry, but I feel like the things they've chosen to publish have also been sort of very timely and kind of relevant. I've just been...
Wait, why am I going to get angry? I have no problem with the Annals of Internal Medicine.
No. So it's going to sound vaguely... So now you're going to make me say it. But like, I feel like sort of some of our institutions of science and research have been under attack. I think there's been defunding and things that are actually very, very important. And yet in April, and I don't know if this is an editorial impulse, but I think it must have been, a lot of what they published were potential clinical and economic impacts of cutbacks in the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief in South Africa, a modeling analysis. So they talked about the cuts to the HIV program. They talked about excess mortality rate in Black children since 1950 in the United States. And they did a great study on health inequities. So like, it seems like some of what they published has been a direct sort of signal like, hey, we think this stuff is important, even though some of the funding is going away for it. And there have been some political forces kind of fighting it. So I think ideologically, and again, this is why I wasn't sure if this was the time to mention it, but I'm kind of pleased with what they've chosen to publish and how they've addressed things. Cause I think it's important, not relevant at all to what I'm going to talk about right now, but thank you for the chance to actually say that part out loud, Ben.
Yeah, I did it. I didn't know that's what you were getting at, Paul, but people come here for your opinions, Paul. They want to know what you think. So I'm glad that you got a chance to tell them that.
Don't threaten me with a good time. I'll do this all day, Watto. This episode is brought to you by Bombas. People talk a lot about spring cleaning, but here's what we should really be talking about. Bombas spring socks. Yep, you heard that right. It's a busy time of the year, and the right socks can make or break your spring. What about running goals? Are you ready to actually commit to your new running hobby? Bombas thoughtfully designed blister-fighting, sweat-wicking athletic socks help you get from mile one to marathon in comfort and in style. It's wedding season. Are you looking for a nice pair to wear to a wedding? Bombas Ultra Soft Dress Socks are made for heels and all of your other hard-bottom party shoes. I have so many hard-bottom party shoes. They are engineered to keep you comfortable enough to hit the dance floor one more time. What about everyday errands? Bombas makes the ultimate errand sock, from actually spring cleaning to walking the dog to everything in between. Bombas took their socks' arch-hugging, stay-up cuff, ultra-cushion design very seriously so you can take a load off. Head-to-toe comfort. You know what goes great with new spring socks? Fresh white tees, waterproof slides, and a few pairs of buttery, soft, seamless underwear. Bombas makes all of that, too. And now, Bombas offers international shipping. In addition to the U.S., they now ship to over 200 countries. Folks, maybe you were like me. You'd heard the Bombas advertisements, and you thought, how good can socks and underwear be? How good can a plain white t-shirt be? And I'm here to tell you, now that I have a couple pairs of Bombas socks and a really nice white t-shirt, I can't go back. It's kind of like having a dishwasher or first-class air travel, so I'm told. But once you have these luxurious socks and t-shirts, it's going to be hard to go back to the El Cheapo stuff that you had before. Bombas started making socks when they learned that they're the number one most requested clothing item in homeless shelters. So, thank you for shopping with Bombas. You've helped donate over 150 million essential items. Now that's a lot of socks and a lot of kindness. Head over to bombas.com/curb and use code CURB for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/curb, code CURB at checkout. The paper, Matt, is actually looking at gabapentin versus duloxetine in terms of falls in older patients. And this is a study by Chaitoff et al., recently published. And their question that they asked, which is hugely clinically relevant for me, is, does the initiation of gabapentin therapy for patients specifically, Matt, with neuropathic pain, fibromyalgia, increase the risk of falls or fall-related events compared to duloxetine? And it's a important study because we prescribe gabapentin a lot. Like, we prescribe it for its indicated reasons, but also there's a ton of off-label use. It's used for things like alcohol use disorder and for non-neuropathic pain and for anxiety. And none of these things are what the FDA indications are for it. So gabapentin is a hugely prescribed medication. So, and the concern is it has a lot of side effects that we've discussed in detail in prior episodes, including dizziness and potentially increased falls in older patients. And so this study wanted to look at, is gabapentin riskier than a comparable medication in terms of causing falls in older patients? So really important clinical question. And this, I'll give away the punchline right now. No is what these authors came up with looking at the study, but let me tell you how it was done. And I'd actually like to hear a little bit from Rahul et al. About how this was kind of got away from some of the potential sources of bias here. But this was a new user active comparator study that used a trial emulation framework, which I just feel smarter even saying out loud. So basically, they looked at this huge, sinister sounding data set from IBM at patients over the age of 65 with the diagnosis of either diabetic neuropathy, postherpetic neuralgia, or fibromyalgia, and then looked at those patients who were prescribed either gabapentin or duloxetine. And then looked at what the primary outcome was, whether or not they had a fall-related event or not. And so the reason they chose duloxetine is because it is prescribed for comparable indications, but works differently. So it's a way of sort of having a comparison that is kind of fair as opposed to comparing it to nothing at all. And I thought this was a really clever design. And the authors themselves even talked about some of the biases it can mitigate against. But I would actually love to hear from our resident epidemiologist and Laura if they had any thoughts about how that kind of addresses certain problems preemptively.
Yeah. Yeah. I was giddy reading the method section of this paper because right off the bat, you can anticipate that this would be a difficult question to study. Outside the context of a randomized trial where you're really not controlling why people get started on the medications they get started on, it's just so hard to disentangle the reasons why, you know, any of us might choose one medication over another. So that's kind of the central, you know, problem of observational research. And Paul, you mentioned that the study used an active comparator new user design and a target trial emulation framework. I actually think that the former, the active comparator new user, is kind of the most important design feature of this study. That exists to try to do a couple things, including controlling confounding by indication. These are all people who were felt to need a medication to treat a symptom like neuropathic pain. And then studying new users really prevents incorporating patients who've been on a medication for a long time who might be different than somebody who is seeking care during the study period and initiating the medicine at that time. So to me, that's the sort of strongest design for a retrospective cohort study asking a question like this. And all target trial emulation means is that they're really being specific about, you know, what the inclusion and exclusion criteria would be if this were a randomized trial, what they would be measuring, the duration of follow-up, et cetera. So when you see target trial emulation, you should just think, okay, this is still a retrospective cohort study and is going to be vulnerable to all the sources of bias and residual confounding that any observational study will be vulnerable to, but that the authors are kind of saying, hey, we know what we're doing and we've thought about this and you can decide what you think of our methods.
I had to look all that up. I know we've talked about a trial like this. I think maybe Paul did another one that was this kind of trial recently.
My second trial, emulation trial, that's right.
Yes, but I still had to refresh myself, but it comes back quicker the second time, Paul. So I think I'm getting there. Laura, what about you? What were your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think as you said before, I think as a hospitalist, this is incredibly important topic. I know that I care for patients who present with falls all the time. And we know that falls are a significant cause of morbidity and mortality, especially in older adults. And when someone comes in with a fall, I'm always thinking about medications as a possible contributing factor. And one medication that comes up pretty frequently is gabapentin. And so I do think that, you know, looking at this is incredibly helpful. And I agree in terms of the active comparator design. I think that is very unique because basically it compares gabapentin use to another treatment option, in this case, duloxetine, rather than comparing gabapentin users to non-medication users, as many of the prior studies have done. And by comparing the gabapentin users to the non-users, that can certainly overestimate gabapentin's fall risk, especially since we know that patients with diagnosis like neuropathy would have an increased fall risk even without medications. And to build on that, I think in the real world, these patients would likely get some medication, even if it isn't gabapentin. So I do like the idea of this active comparative design. I think it may be more realistic.
My concern with this, Paul, is that if you look at like what's the headline going to be for this, it's like gabapentin does not cause falls, which I think is like a dangerous conclusion to draw from this. And they were looking at a specific population of people with neuropathy. This wasn't, you know, people with radiculopathy or your like older adult with sleep problems or, you know, any of the other fair like number of reasons that you mentioned for off-label use of this. And then I also noticed that the median starting dose of gabapentin was 200. So can you talk about that? Because that's a low dose and you see people on like up to 3,600 milligrams of this, which is a very high dose.
I think that's one of the limitations of the study that the authors acknowledge. And I just want to be a little bit more explicit about the bottom line. I think your point is exactly right, Matt. I do worry about what the headlines might read. So, but the conclusion is that the top line result is that incident gabapentin users had a lower hazard ratio for falls compared to duloxetine users, which is sort of stunning to think about. But anyway, the point being is gabapentin being safe is a potentially dangerous takeaway, which I agree with. And to your point, and the authors raise this too, is that I think you titrate gabapentin in very different ways than duloxetine. Duloxetine has like a couple of doses that you use, and sometimes the starting dose is really the dose that you end up on. Gabapentin, I think we all know there's potential for side effects. And so we start low and go slow. And this study did not look at a really long period of time where these patients may have actually been titrated to the dose that causes the problem that we're actually looking for. So if you're getting 200 milligrams per day or starting 100 milligrams at HS, like you say, you know, there's nowhere to go but up for these poor patients who are often prescribed it for things like chronic low back pain, even though there's no data to support that stuff. So while this captures, I think, an important group of patients, it doesn't fully capture the population I'd be most interested in terms of patients who are on gabapentin at higher doses, which is where people tend to land, because gabapentin by its very nature is a little bit of a Hail Mary pass that you do when other medications have not worked. So I think this is not fully captured the way that gabapentin is used. And so I think it's limited in that way.
The median follow-up was it 30 days? It was really short, right?
Yeah, it went as far out as 6 months, which I know if you're doing like follow-up visits for gabapentin titration, this is not something that I'm seeing a patient for on like, you know, a monthly basis.
Yeah. I mean, I found myself wondering, I mean, trying to answer the question, why didn't this find a signal for increased falls with gabapentin? Because I think that was definitely my prior going in, was that, okay, gabapentin is going to be, you know, horrible for people in terms of side effects. And then to sort of, you know, use the framing of a positive or a negative study, this shows that one of the arbitrary limitations of that framing, because, you know, an association was found between gabapentin and falls, but it was in the opposite direction of what we expected. So why was an increased signal for falls from gabapentin not seen? You know, you mentioned the short duration of follow-up. The duration of therapy was also really short in this study because patients were censored after 14 days of discontinuation of the medication. And so that meant that the average treatment duration in this study was only like 4 to 6 weeks. And so, you know, I often will see patients for whom gabapentin gets parked on their medication list, you know, for years, and their renal function changes, their volume of distribution changes. Yes. And those are patients who I would hesitate to apply these results of this, I think, well-done study to. And so just thinking about, you know, do the patients that you have this question about, you know, are they represented in what could otherwise be a very well-done study?
And I think duloxetine is not titrated to the same degree, at least I haven't seen, as gabapentin. So I think that the dosing question is a huge one and could potentially make a big difference.
Okay, Paul, what any other points to make about this one? Are you ready for kind of take-home points on this one?
Yeah, no, I'm ready to give it some hotcakes, I will say. I'm going to go for hotcakes, man. I think it's a really well-designed study. I love this paper. I just think that there are limitations that I think even the authors acknowledge. So I think it was put together in a really neat way and very thoughtful. So I liked it a lot. That's a really important question. I think it just did not fully capture the patient population that I think is most applicable to my practice. And I'd love to see, a broader study looking at that kind of group, but it's still beautifully designed. May not change much what I do though.
Well, we should move on because Rahul has an unpronounceable drug that he's going to talk about and tell us whether or not we should be using this for urinary tract infections.
Okay, let's see how many different ways I can pronounce this in the next 7 minutes. Okay. First of all, I apologize to all of you for choosing this paper because, boy, was it a doozy. And it just took me a while to get through. So I feel for all of you. But fortunately, we all read this. So listeners, you don't have to. This paper is called Oral Gepotidacin versus Nitrofurantoin in Patients with Uncomplicated Urinary Tract Infection. And this is the result of not one, but two randomized trials. And this appeared in a February 2024 issue of The Lancet. I have to note before we start talking about this, these trials were both funded by the manufacturer of this medication, GlaxoSmithKline, and all the authors are either employees or advisors to the company.
Rahul, can we ask Paul what he thinks about the Eagle title for this?
Please, Paul.
Yeah, I'm furiously flipping through the paper to see if I can figure out where even that acronym comes from.
I tried to look this up. Maybe I used AI to try to look this up, Paul, but it said it could not find anything, and I couldn't find it either. So I think they just chose a word they liked.
Why Eagle then? That can't be right. All right, I'm going to be lightly distracted as you go on, Rahul, but I have to crack this case wide open. But for right now, boo, D-.
All right. While Paul is going down that rabbit hole, I'll tell you a little bit about the research question. So both of these trials sought to answer the question of whether oral gepotidacin is non-inferior to nitrofurantoin for the treatment of uncomplicated urinary tract infection, that is simple cystitis, no evidence of ascending infection or pyelonephritis, in adolescent and adult women. So why is this study important? Well, this antibiotic, I need to keep practicing the name, gepotidacin. This is important because gepotidacin received FDA approval in March of this year, 2025, for treatment of women age 12 and older with an uncomplicated UTI on the basis of these two studies. So that's why I want to bring this to our listeners' attention. And it's a novel mechanism of action. It works by inhibiting DNA gyrase and topoisomerase 4, which I'm sure you all remember are the enzymes inhibited by fluoroquinolones.
There's no need to insult the audience, Rahul.
That felt insulting as I was saying it. But it binds at a site that's different from fluoroquinolones. So the hope is that that's going to limit cross resistance with fluoroquinolones. So there was a point there, I promise. Okay, so what do the authors find? The authors' top line results, Eagle 2 and Eagle 3 were both positive non-inferiority trials. Okay. And in addition, Eagle 3 showed it was positive for superiority for gepotidacin, okay? And in both trials, the non-inferiority margin was 10%, and both trials were stopped early for efficacy. So to give you a little more detail on what the outcome was, in Eagle 2, gepotidacin led to therapeutic success at 10 to 13 days, and that was defined as complete symptom resolution plus a 2-log or greater reduction in the uropathogen colony count on test of cure, 51% versus 47% with nitrofurantoin. And then in Eagle 3, the numbers were 59% with gepotidacin versus only 44% with nitrofurantoin. So a difference of about 15% in absolute terms that met criteria for superiority as well as non-inferiority. And before I open it up to the group, I also just have to say adverse events were really mild and rare. Diarrhea happened, I guess not that really, 15 to 20% of patients getting gepotidacin. Nausea in about 10% compared with only about 5% of patients on nitrofurantoin. And C. diff, fortunately, was really uncommon, less than 1%. But all 8 cases of C. diff did occur in patients receiving the study drug. So I'm curious what people think. Before I tell you more details about how the study was done and who the patients were, any questions that kind of bubble to the front of your minds at this point?
Can I provide an update that Eagle is efficacy of antibacterial gepotidacin evaluated? So kind of a mess. So up to a C-, since there are some letters that actually match up there. But yeah, not great, team.
Well, I'm glad you found something, Paul. That's better than I did with my 5-second search for that. you know, this just to remind the audience, there was it's not a new med, but pivmecillinam, that was from 2024. That was an antibiotic that's been in the IDSA guidelines for a while. We covered that on a previous Hotcakes or Digest episode. And that one, I have yet to start seeing that one out in the wild. So I think it'll be a little while before we start seeing this one as well. But it is it is good to have a new medication here. Rahul, what struck me when you were talking there is just the test of cure, or the fact that they did a test of cure, which we don't routinely do for UTI. We usually just go by clinical symptoms, and the fact that the numbers were relatively low, like around 50%, you know, a pretty strict way to go about it, like by saying, okay, no clinical symptoms have to be resolved plus this, you know, 2-log difference in colony count. So, you know, because we usually just go by clinical symptoms.
For sure. I thought you might ask about that, Matt. So I have something ready to say to you about that. Yeah, it is unusual as far as, you know, what we do in clinical practice. We don't routinely do a test of cure. So why would the study authors incorporate that? Well, there's two reasons. One is that regulators actually want more stringent outcomes than just clinical symptom resolution alone. So that partially was a requirement of regulators. But you can also think of this as being a very stringent primary outcome. And that's probably why rates of therapeutic success were generally lower in this study than what they expected. They powered the trial expecting to see about a 75-76% reduction, a 76% rate of therapeutic success. So that's probably why it was lower in this study. Both of these studies were identical, except for the collection of some additional data that was not published in these papers. Patients had to be enrolled within 4 days of symptom onset, and then they were randomized 1-to-1 to take either the study drug, which is dosed 1,500 milligrams BID for 5 days, or nitrofurantoin 100 milligrams twice daily for 5 days. They assessed symptoms by interview over the course of 4 study visits, and they collected urine for culture both at baseline and for test of cure. And another cool thing about these studies, the primary analysis population was limited to people who had nitrofurantoin susceptible organisms. And you can think that, you know, you might want to use this drug in patients who have nitrofurantoin resistant organisms. So why would they do that? Well, it's really to level the playing field and ensure that if patients had been randomized to nitrofurantoin, that they would have been sort of eligible to achieve therapeutic success from that random allocation. So kind of a cool thing. The study included just over 3,100 patients who were getting care at 219 sites all over the world, either general practice, OB-GYN, or urologists in 18 countries. The mean age was in the low 50s, 85% were white. About 40% of women had a history of recurrent UTIs, and only half of patients ended up having a nitrofurantoin susceptible pathogen, and these are mostly E. coli. There's a few other gram negatives as well as Enterococcus in there as well. So other thoughts?
I'm sure you're going to get to this, but I think one of the other big things that we need to talk about is these were stopped early. Is that right?
Yes. And I welcome thoughts from the group on this. In a superiority trial, I could kind of imagine clearly the implications of stopping a study early. But stopping a non-inferiority trial early for efficacy, I'm still having a bit of a hard time wrapping my head around this, because a positive non-inferiority trial, or a trial in which non-inferiority is shown, is one where the two treatments are equivalent. So I'm struggling to sort of understand. I mean, in Eagle 3, superiority was shown, so that might have been why these trials were stopped. They weren't exactly contemporaneous, so I don't know why they would have stopped both of them. But yeah, in my mind, stopping early falls into kind of a broader category of, okay, what are some sources of, you know, chance or bias that could explain non-inferiority in these trials? You know, we talked a little bit about the requiring nitrofurantoin susceptibility. That is a source of selection bias. But in my mind, that's kind of a strength, because not doing that would have been a source towards Gepotidacin and being better. So, you know, limiting the analysis to only women who had NTF susceptible bugs, it does also decrease the power to find a difference, which biases towards equivalence. So it's really hard to figure out, you know, in which direction the net benefit of that or the net effect of that is going to be. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Stopping early just gives you're just assessing less cases, and, you know, it's less of a chance for, I mean, there could be maybe just if you kept going and you got more people, then it would have evened it out, or maybe even nitrofurantoin would have become better if you assessed the full cohort that they had planned.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, and so there's a bunch of ways that you could categorize, you know, the study as being underpowered, you know, having fewer people or events available for analysis than planned. Mm-hmm. And in a non-inferiority trial, you know, it's very situational, but I could see that being a source of bias towards equivalence.
Yeah. Laura, did you have comments?
Yeah, I think about when and how this medication is going to be used. And I think that's an important consideration. I know that on one side, it's very exciting that this is, a new oral antibiotic for uncomplicated UTIs. And we haven't seen a new oral antibiotic for this use in over 20 years. I think there are some definite benefits, including, a new novel mechanism of action, and especially with rising antibiotic resistance. I think that's very important. And I also think that a lot of medications for multi-drug resistant bugs are IV at this point, and this is oral. So I think there's a lot of potential. But I also wonder, in terms of the cost, I don't know if we have a good idea about the cost and how that's going to play into the whole equation. So I guess one of my questions is, where do you see this medication going? And do you think it'll be used in very specific situations or more broadly?
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious from, really Matt and Paul, those of you who actually do outpatient medicine and see people in this situation. I mean, on the one hand, I could see it being great to have another tool in the toolbox. But on the other hand, I could also see it being, difficult to, justify the increased cost of something that so far has its approval data is showing that it's comparable to nitrofurantoin. Eagle 3 was positive for superiority, but, something that's going to be more expensive with more side effects. I'm thinking it's probably going to end up being reserved for cases with resistance.
That's I guess where I struggled a little bit with this in terms of, what we're comparing it to is sort of, we're evaluating was for a treatment of sort of bog standard UTIs, like by dint, the infections that we were looking for were relatively straightforward, but does not seem to be a medication that you would select if you had for straightforward UTIs, because we already have tools in our armamentarium for that. So it seems like it's designed for something that would be resistant. So I'm not quite sure what to do with all this information. It's exciting to have another oral agent, but seems to me the utility would be more towards something where you have a resistant bug as opposed to something you sort of reach for first line. And that's not how it seemed to be studied for this necessarily. So I'm a little bit I'll still wait and see what things look like as they continue to look at this.
I don't expect to have to be prescribing this anytime soon, but I do think it's great that we have, because we only have a couple oral agents that are first line. I mentioned pivmecillinam will be coming around, and this will be coming around, and those two are both going to be more expensive and probably relegated to cases where we've exhausted other options and there's no other oral options. And I think it'll be ID docs that are prescribing it early on, or urologists, that are seeing people with more resistant organisms.
Matt, those are my exact thought. This is going to be the antibiotic that someone pulls, like your ID friend pulls out of their back pocket. Like, what about this one that you'd forgotten about since we haven't actually talked about it since the paper came out? Like, you'll be like, oh, that's right, this exists. So, but it's not going to be one that we think of first line. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah. It has been around for a couple of years in studies been studied in skin and soft tissue infection. It didn't really work for that. There is an ongoing phase 3 trial of oral dosing for urogenital gonorrhea, and it showed some promising activity in phase 2 studies.
Oh, great.
Else for that super gonorrhea. So that's great news if that works.
Yeah. Yeah. So, stay tuned. There will hopefully be more information coming down the pike on that. Matt, would you like my hotcakes rating?
Yeah, let's get it.
Okay. For me, this is a 3 out of 5. I'm excited to have more options for uncomplicated UTI, but I just can't get over, this comparable efficacy to nitrofurantoin and more side effects at what is likely going to be a higher cost. So I don't know if I can say confidently just yet that the eagle has landed.
Yeah. Well, we have
nothing. I was dying to pull that one out.
I know. God. You've been sitting on that for like 45 minutes now. Yeah. I'm happy for you, Rebel.
We love it.
I was just going to ignore it and just power on, Paul. But you really, I think Paul secretly loves puns. That's what this is.
No, I openly love Rahul, and that's the difference. The puns I won't take, but
if the trial had a good acronym, then Paul would be very interested.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trial with a good acronym, we'll get to see. So, Laura, you're going to be talking about intermittent fasting. Tell us about your trial.
Yeah. So I'm going to be talking about a paper that looked at the comparing the effects of 4-3 intermittent fasting versus daily caloric restriction with a comprehensive behavioral support program on weight loss at 12 months. And before I get into kind of what the study showed, I think it's important to talk a little bit about intermittent fasting, as that's a big component of the study. So intermittent fasting which is an eating pattern that alternates between periods of eating and fasting, has become a very popular weight loss strategy. And there are several different methods of intermittent fasting, which include complete or near complete caloric restriction for a certain number of days per week. And some people think that intermittent fasting provides more diet flexibility, which may lead to better adherence and greater success with weight loss, especially in the long term. And prior studies are limited, but have actually not shown a significant difference in weight loss between intermittent fasting and daily calorie restriction. But results from this new study show otherwise. So in a recent randomized controlled trial published in Annals of Internal Medicine, as Paul said, they're killing it, 165 overweight or obese adults were randomly assigned to follow a 4-3 intermittent fasting diet, in which they reduced calorie intake by 80% on 3 non-consecutive days of the week, with no restrictions on the other 4 days of the week, versus a traditional daily calorie-restricted diet, in which they reduced calorie intake by 34% daily throughout the week, with the primary outcome being change in body weight at 12 months. Importantly, both these groups also received a high-intensity comprehensive weight loss program, which included behavioral support, information on portion control, calorie counting, healthy food choices, as well as a gym membership and encouragement to exercise 300 minutes per week. So pretty significant. And of the 165 participants originally, only 125 participants actually completed the study. So that's, you know, an important point. And after the 12-month period, participants in the 4-3 intermittent fasting group experienced a statistically significant reduction in weight compared to the daily caloric restriction group, with the intermittent fasting group losing an average of 7.6% of their body weight compared to 5% in the daily caloric restriction group. Also, both groups did show improvements in secondary outcomes of cardiometabolic risk factors, with the majority of these secondary outcomes favoring the intermittent fasting group, although the authors do acknowledge that the study was underpowered to detect statistically significant differences in these secondary endpoints. So I'm just going to pause there and open up to you guys and hear your thoughts on the study.
I believe there's an acronym for this one. Do you want to tell Paul and see what he thinks? Otherwise, I have it ready if you don't.
Yeah. But what's the acronym?
I believe this was the DRIFT trial, restriction versus intermittent fasting trial.
Look, that's great. Yeah. That's it. Bravo. Good for them. See, these people are taking their title seriously. God bless.
The authors are just like drifting some sort of like, I don't know, Nissan GT or something like that. Like a Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift right now, Paul. Just celebrating your approval.
So we have 5 out of 5 for the acronym. But what are your thoughts on the other parts of the paper?
Well, you said you gave us the percentages, but it was...
So there were 165 original participants. Oh, you're talking about in terms of the weight loss?
In terms of the weight loss. So it was like 7.7 kilograms in the in the fasting group and 4.8 kilograms lost in the calorie restriction group.
Right.
So both groups lost, I would say, a significant amount of weight, like 15 pounds or more in the intermittent fasting and around 10 pounds in the calorie restriction group. So, I mean, I think it's a significant amount of weight loss in both groups, but also a significant difference. I think that, you know, extra 5 or so pounds probably matters to the people that lost it.
Yeah. I was struck reading the result of this study by the study setting, thinking about kind of where this occurred and, you know, how they could have achieved this positive finding. Because in the introduction, they sort of describe how, you know, prior studies of intermittent fasting have really been negative with respect in comparison to daily calorie restriction. So why would this be a positive study? This, you know, was a single center study, which is always going to be vulnerable to a chance positive finding. Simply because a single stenter implementing something, you know, they're going to be interested in it. They're going to probably have some expertise in doing this. So if those findings hold up across multiple centers, that increases our confidence that it's due to the truth. So single center study, it's, you know, vulnerable to false positives. And then realizing that this study was done in Denver, where I don't know about the rest of you, but everybody I know who lives in Denver is what I would call outdoorsy and kind of, you know, enjoys physical activity. That's a huge generalization, obviously. But the study population, they give you some characteristics in table one. These are people who generally were highly educated, generally more affluent. And so I kind of think about this study population in which these results were shown, and how would that generalize to the population at large?
They were also, and this probably goes in keeping with the demographics, very healthy. And part of that was by dint of the exclusion criteria as well. So I'm not sure how this affects the end results, but does not, again, going back to capture a group that I'd be interested in, because the people that I'm trying to counsel to lose weight are people that have things like diabetes or cardiovascular disease, or even to some extent, I suppose, depression. But the reason I mention these things specifically is because they're all exclusion criteria for the trial. So like, you know, I worry about is like the dysmetabolic stuff. And like that was not super well represented by design in this particular study. And I don't know that it impacts the outcome all that much. But it also, again, the study participants were not exactly the people I'd be most interested in terms of who this study would apply to in my own practice, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And looking at the table one, the people who completed the trial were more likely to be highly educated, have more money, be married. Like there was just some things about it that I think, you know, definitely could have affected the results at least a bit when you're looking at the people that were able to complete the study, or if you're just trying to apply this to the real world, I should say. You know, it seemed like it was easier to stay in the study if you were highly educated and had enough money and maybe some support from a partner. You know, that
I might venture to say it's easier to do almost anything if you have those things. Yes,
right. Yeah.
And I think also that the behavioral component was a very intensive kind of support system. And I think that's important to consider too when we think about generalizability.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is something to the hypothesis that maybe it's easier to stick with something that you don't have to do every day. I mean, there was differential loss to follow-up in figure one. You can see that about 80% of people who were randomly assigned to intermittent fasting completed the trial, and that was only about 70% of people in the daily calorie restriction group. And both groups actually underachieved as far as the total intended amount of weekly calorie restriction. So this is hard to do, even with a very intensive behavioral support system in place.
I mean, I'm generally supportive if people want to do fasting or calorie restriction, like however, you know, if they're trying to lose weight, I'm generally supportive of it. And I think the behavioral stuff they did and the exercise support they did here was great. And I just try to talk to people about if they are restricting calories heavy like this, that they really make the ones that they're eating count, that they're eating enough protein, that they're eating high quality foods and not just spending all their calories on garbage. So I don't know, Paul, what your thoughts as a primary care? Are people talking to you about this much?
I've not been asked about this much. I agree with Rahul and I agree with you. I think this sounds more palatable to me than just being miserable every single day of the week. You know what I mean? So I think that the fact that it does seem to have some benefit, especially compared to sort of the more traditional calorie restriction, I think even the patients in the intermittent fasting group actually on average consume fewer calories regardless. So if this is a way to get people to decrease the caloric intake in a way that is more palatable to them, that's fantastic. And I'm still excited about it. So I think our job is to look for limitations, but I am happy to see something that has some evidence to support it. That's another way to potentially try to lose weight, since it's just so hard to do. So if someone wants to try it, you know, it's go with God. There's enough evidence that I would be supportive of them.
Yeah.
One area that I was curious if any of you knew anything about in the secondary outcomes, you know, because then it's reasonable to ask Paul, like, is there any downside to trying intermittent fasting? And you know, some of the secondary outcomes are kind of making the gears turn in my brain. I mean, you know, people in the intermittent fasting group had a greater loss of lean mass than people in the daily calorie restriction. And this is definitely outside of my subject matter knowledge. I mean, it did seem like there were metabolic differences. Like but you know, the other side of that coin, people in the intermittent fasting group had a lower HOMA IR score, which I understand has to do with insulin resistance. So it seems like there might also be metabolic implications of the strategy that people pursue to lose weight, and you know, whether you could use those, whether somebody who knows more than me could use those to counsel patients. I wonder.
Yeah. I mean, they on my YouTube is one of the few, I guess, pseudo social media type things that I use. There's like, they have these scales that'll tell people their body composition, that they're always sort of, I'm getting commercials for that constantly, but they're, I think a lot of gyms now will have those things. And so I think patients could really monitor that and make sure that they're not losing as much lean mass. But I do actually, I don't know, Paul, if this is part of my standard counseling, when I'm talking to people about GLP-1 agonists and weight loss, I tell them like, you will lose weight if you take this and don't exercise, but I recommend you exercise because I want you to maintain muscle and lose fat. Mm. And if you're not exercising and you're just calorie restricting and taking these weight loss drugs, you will lose like lean mass that we need. And some patients can't afford to lose it. Mm. Or most patients can't afford, I should say most patients can't afford to lose it.
And I, you know, have older patients that ask about these agents all the time. And that's really one of my main considerations for not starting them, is that the concern for the loss of lean mass. Yeah. So I agree. It's something I lean into fairly heavily regardless of your weight loss modality. I think it's an important thing to pay attention to. So that's a great point to raise.
Yeah. So I think that it's probably going to become more part of the public consciousness as more people are losing weight, and where there's these tools that are lower cost that are just out there that are measuring like body composition, people are using them. And I think people will just, it'll be numbers that people know that they just didn't know before, like their body fat, their muscle mass and things like that. Anything else, Lara, are you ready for your take home, give your final take home points and your hotcakes rating for this?
I'm ready for it.
All right, let's hear it.
So I'm going to give this paper a 3.5 out of 5, which is, you know, good. And I do think that 4-3 intermittent fasting diet should be considered as an alternative to the daily caloric restriction for weight loss, especially when paired with the behavioral weight loss program in adults, as it may provide greater weight loss and also better adherence, which I think is a huge component. I do, however, worry about the trial's generalizability, especially when considering feasibility and accessibility of the intensive comprehensive behavioral support component, especially kind of in the outpatient setting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Paul, any final words? Anything you wanted to say before we go to our outro? I mean, I'm having so much fun. I just don't want to leave the show here.
Nope.
Rahul, Lara, anything from you?
We should do 8 papers next time.
I feel like we've done that
it's
before.
It's too hard to read all these papers. This is I don't read good, Paul. I mean, I don't know about you, but. But Rahul and Lara, thank you so much for joining us. This is always fun. I work my butt off to try to get ready for this. And then it's always just such a joy to sit here and go through these papers and learn a bunch from people that are smarter than me. So thank you.
I feel the same.
So great to learn from all of you.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole. Anyone yummy? Is anyone gonna take it? We're still hungry for more? Join our Patreon. All our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com. And while you're there, sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest with heavy contributions from the great Dr. Laura Glick, recapping the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we want your feedback, so you can email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And I wanted to give a special thanks to our wonderful co-hosts, Dr. Rahul Ganatra and Dr. Lara Glick. And to our whole Curbsiders team, our technical production is done by the team at PodPaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Krista Chumanchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
I've been Dr. Rahul Ganatra.
I've been Dr. Laura Glick.
A couple of pros here, Watto. And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson-Williams. Thank you and goodbye.